Today's episode of A Novel Podcast is sponsored by Audible, and many of the books we'll be discussing on today's episode are available on Audible.com's audiobook library. A Novel Podcast listeners can get a free trial and a free download of any audiobook by going to audibletrial.com/anovelpodcast.
You are listening to A Novel Podcast, in-depth discussions of literature from all genres and generations. I'm your host, Russell, and I'm joined today by my wife, Sarah, and our good friend, Andrew. And today we're discussing two nonfiction books in the astrophysics genre, Fabric of the Cosmos by Brian Greene and Astrophysics for People in a Hurry by Neil deGrasse Tyson. Fair warning to all our listeners, we will be discussing these books in detail, and if spoilers are possible, they will be given. So if you've not yet read these books and you want to go in fresh, turn off your radio now. I would like to start by asking Andrew, who suggested Astrophysics for People in a Hurry, what it was that drew him to this book, what he enjoyed about it, and why he recommended us for us to read.
Yeah, absolutely. So I read A Brief History in Time by Stephen Hawking a while back, and I have no science background at all, so no expertise in that genre. And it really kind of broke down his theory, well, not his theory of relativity, but just his general science perspective and also a couple different theories, and really helped me understand kind of the world and the universe that I exist in. And so especially when Astrophysics for People in a Hurry came out, I was excited to read it. And also Fabric of the Cosmos provides a good backdrop to that as well and goes a little bit more in depth. But both of them really kind of put all of this very, very complicated information in layman's terms, which is super easy to digest. And therefore, I was excited to kind of learn more about space and time and all that stuff, because at the end of the day, I feel like my knowledge is so basic, most likely with the majority of people in our world. And it's nice to kind of have that snapshot or insight into this very, very complicated topics. So that's kind of why I wanted to read it.
I concur quite a bit with all of those sentiments. I have never studied physics past, intro to physics in college, and still thoroughly enjoyed this, especially being a Star Trek and science fiction fan in general. I feel like this is leading us in that direction, and I want to understand as best as I can. I enjoyed both of them because they were technical and advanced, but without being not understandable. They were very understandable. Now, Sarah, you have never expressed any interest in astrophysics.
I took astronomy in college.
What did you think of, and you did not get to both of them, but what did you think of the one you read?
I read Astrophysics for People in a Hurry, and it took me back to the college astronomy course. I liked it a lot. I think Tyson does a good job of taking really complex information and describing it in a way that's easily understood, relatively easily understood. That being said, it was pretty dense, pretty densely packed, which I guess was the point. The title is Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't a lot of fluff and not a lot of space between concepts.
Yeah, it was definitely dense, as you say, much shorter than Fabric of the Cosmos. I felt like Fabric of the Cosmos was a bit more approachable because he took a lot of time to turn it into a bit of a narrative. And although it was more than twice the length, he put a real human spin on it that I think Astrophysics was missing. Did you have an opinion about that, Andrew?
Yeah, for sure. And the Astrophysics for People in a Hurry just... Some a little bit of background were a bunch of essays that Neil deGrasse Tyson had written before, and I think he kind of turned it in, or maybe kind of combined them all to just gloss over these very complicated topics. But yeah, I think that, and that's what's interesting about these two individuals, and not just these two alone. We also have other people like Bill Nye the Science Guy or Stephen Hawking when he was alive, of these individuals who are really able to take that very complicated information and, for lack of a better term, dumb it down. And in the Fabric of the Cosmos, for sure, I mean, not only does he create the narrative, but he also definitely dives into more complicated topics and makes them more simplistic, while Neil deGrasse Tyson is very surface level explanatory stuff like that, and kind of the wow factor, which Green does as well a little bit, but he's also, I think, a little bit more practical in the way that he constructs the book and writes about it. And it does sometimes come off as a lecture at some points, but at the same time, it's like, it's still very basic and easy to digest. So that's what I really liked about it, as one of those things. And also, I mean, he got way deeper into dark matter and like dark energy and that type of stuff, which I really liked in general, because it's, I guess it's considered a new, somewhat new phenomenon in the physics field. And so it was really interesting for him to go really deep into it. And because Neil deGrasse Tyson talks about it, but he kind of talks about it that it's like a standard thing and it exists and we should all just accept that. And Green really kind of belabors over the point that this is a very new area of this study. And as a result, there's people like 10 years ago or 15 years ago, 20 years ago, who weren't even thinking about this type of stuff. So,
yeah, I concur, especially at the end of Astrophysics. The very end of it, Neil has this bit of a lecture. It's the best way for me to describe it. It almost felt like it was getting entirely too preachy. But then when he gets to the end of it and he wraps up with his final point and he starts discussing what he calls the cosmic perspective, I felt like, well, I just really enjoyed that. And I felt like that is something that I could really latch on to. He calls it the cosmic perspective, and I see it as a method of thought that can keep humanity humble and hopeful at the same time. Sure, there's a lot out there that we have no idea what's going on, but at the same time, we have made such advances over the last, 2,000 years, even just the last 50 years, that we're going to continue to learn new things. And I although it started out feeling very preachy and lecturous, I enjoyed his point. I enjoyed where he took us very much.
You felt like it started preachy and lecturous? Yeah. Is that a word?
No, I don't think it is.
I don't think so either.
Yeah, at first I thought, Neil, okay, we get it. You don't need to tell us how to live our lives. You don't need to tell us how to think. But then he says, but maybe you could think this way and this way. And I thought, yeah, not only could I, but I agree with you. I think we should.
Right. And I also thought he did that. It's funny because it kind of came full circle because he did do that in the beginning as well. Like when he was describing the like a second happened and this is what has happened in the universe and really breaking it down and explaining it and kind of talking about this perspective of how we should be appreciating why we are a tiny, tiny, tiny little component of this massive entity being the universe and how it came to be. And therefore that perspective is like an amalgamation between like positivity, but also like a desire for learning or wanting to understand even more. And that also might be a sign of the times too, as well. I mean, it's funny because I was reading that chapter, I was thinking about the federal funding for the space program in the United States and how there's kind of been this big thing about NASA not having enough funding over the last 10 to 15 years because it should, well, with private companies like SpaceX and Boeing and all these other larger corporations getting involved and them doing it, but also just the fact that they're allocating funding elsewhere due to economic reasons. But overall, I think that he's definitely making a plea that there should be some preservation, at least in the general rhetoric that we have in our society, that we should still be engaging and curious and trying to understand the world that we live in and how it all interacts. And that really like bleeds into the chapters that he gets into, like really breaking down quantum mechanics and part on like the particle level and stuff like that.
Yeah, I concur. Sarah, do you have an opinion about that?
No, I agree. I think I think when you're reading about astrophysics, it's just sometimes difficult to wrap your head around exactly how big it all is. And one of the first quotes in the book that really jumped out was, he said, 14 billion years ago, all of the matter was concentrated in an area smaller than the period at the end of the sentence.
Yeah.
And I listened to this on audiobook and, I'm on mass public transit in the nation's capital, listening on headphones that are significantly larger than the period at the end of a sentence. And I think it's hard to not let your mind wander at that point about how it all boils down to what we do on a daily basis. When you start thinking about how grandiose the universe really is.
Right, and how far do you take it? And these individuals who are are like spending every single waking moment of trying to figure it all out and trying to progress the actual science behind it, it must be, I don't know, I kind of feel like it's probably extremely rewarding in one sense, but also maddening in another sense, where they're constantly thinking about these larger than global issues that will most likely never be answered in their lifetime, let alone like hundreds and hundreds of years. So,
yeah. But. And then, I mean, my job is essentially pushing pieces of paper around on a desk. So how does that figure into this? It's definitely something to think about. And I definitely found, I would find myself drifting and really thinking about that sort of thing while reading. So that was a struggle that I personally faced. Like, I needed to focus on the material because it was dense and it did spark a lot of imagination and a lot of other thought. I don't really know how to put that into a phrase that sounds more eloquent than that, but
is it existential?
It was pretty existential at some points in time there.
Right. Yeah.
That's one of the things I really enjoyed about Fabric of the Cosmos, because it was so focused on questioning your assumptions about reality and your life. And at no point in time did Brian Greene ever say that your assumptions or your feelings were wrong. He's just constantly saying it's important to question and verify where you're at. And that, of course, leads into what people like Neil deGrasse Tyson and Stephen Hawking and Albert Einstein were doing is trying to take it one step further. And that's really the question, is where are we as a race, species going with all of this? What are we going to discover next? What's around the corner?
Right. Yeah. And that was why I found in both books, really, when they were getting into the, and of course I'm going to butcher all these terms, but so thinking about the way that I try to construct it in my head is that, okay, so we have the theory of relativity, and then we have the way that that applies in terms of gravity and how everything interacts. And then we have quantum theory or quantum physics that is basically describing the interactions of matter on a minuscule level and how there's conflict between those two, like, for lack of a better term, aspects of physics that they're trying to reconcile. And it seemed like, I mean, and that, again, going back to the dark matter, that was kind of like, oh, we haven't figured it out yet, but there's a theory that it could be existing, because then we could bridge the gap. Or I guess maybe it's not dark matter, it's like a theory of quantum gravity, which would explain the gravitational pull between, and that also relates to especially Greene's chapter on string theory, which I believe that's like his claim to fame. Not just the only thing he's done. He's like an insanely smart individual. But at the same time, him bridging that gap between the conflict between how physics evaluates, I think of like planets, and then how quantum mechanics evaluates how atoms or like protons and electrons and stuff like that interact. But all that is to say, it's interesting how he kind of dives in and explains that, but at the same time really goes back to that same general thematic point that you should still be questioning even this, which is interesting to think about.
When you circle back around,
right,
it's you can get pretty deep, I think.
All right, so here's a deep thought. All right, so over the last 2,000 years, scientists have continued to break particles down smaller and smaller and smaller. So we keep diving deeper and deeper into the microcosmos, from molecules into atoms into quarks, and now we're talking about maybe it's all strings, and what's on the other side of that. Is breaking things down smaller and smaller akin to the Tower of Babel? Are we continuing to move higher and higher in that area in an attempt, maybe not an attempt, but is that akin to the same way that the Tower of Babel was trying to reach God? What if this further reasoning and this continuing to find smaller and smaller constituent particles is because that's God putting it there for us, whatever this creator is. So every time we discover something new, he breaks it down and makes something stronger. Is this, as leadership programs are saying, is this happiness being found in the pursuit but not in the actual finding? Or what if life is just human beings on a treadmill, like in exercise programs for angels or other higher beings?
Yeah, that is a very deep thought. The one thing that I always think of is at the end of Men in Black, the movie, when it zooms out of everything, yeah, and then it gets to the end and it's just a giant alien playing with marbles. But that is an interesting thought in turn, especially if you're thinking about how like our perception of reality is in of itself limited and that we can never actually get to the other side. And when, and especially when they were talking about dimensions, because that was really fascinating from my perspective, because, and I'll see how this ties into Russ's question if it does, but how when you're evaluating the actual like particles itself and trying to figure out, hey, okay, is there some elemental connection between the two, and then you break them down and break them down, and it's just the pursuit, the overall pursuit. Is that associated with just the lack of our ability to actually perceive dimensions beyond ours? Because I guess we perceive the dimension below us, and all beings that we know that are in existence perceive the dimension that's below them, or whatever the, like, say we were in the second dimension, then we would view the first dimension, or we would view the second dimension in the first dimension. And is there some like construct that is out there that we just literally can't perceive? I think they use the example with oceans on the earth. It's like, if it's like being a fish in the ocean and not being able to identify the fact that you're in water. And
right.
And so, I mean, realistically, it's interesting because on the one hand, I engage in the question to the nth degree. And on the other hand, I'm like, oh, what if the limitation is that we can never actually perceive anything outside of the dimension that we exist in? And therefore, trying to theorize those other other dimensions ends up being kind of a futile endeavor. And then going back to the initial question is like, oh, maybe there's a third party associated with all of this who's constructing it for us and leading us down the continuous path that we can never get off of.
Mm-hmm. Well, similar to the, like you mentioned, the ending of Men in Black, I think about how I wasn't sure if it was Neil or Brian or both of them who talked about, well, the galaxy, the universe itself is expanding, kind of like dots on a balloon that's blowing up. It keeps getting bigger and everything's getting further away from itself. What happens if you go all the way around? Is there some kind of end? Does it loop back on itself like a Mobius or like a video game where you go off one side of the screen and you wind up on the other side? Does that work when you get bigger and smaller also? I mean, it seems pretty obvious. I'm sure everyone's drawn this conclusion that atoms and solar systems look an awful lot alike each other. You know, you got this giant nucleus or a sun orbited by all these tiny little particles that are going around really, really fast in comparison.
Right.
Is it just that if you just keep getting smaller and smaller, eventually you find yourself again?
Interesting thought.
I'm also always fascinated by movies that try and showcase this. Did you see the movie, blanking on it. It's the one where the Earth is running out of crops, so they have to find a new planet.
Interstellar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how he shows being able to perceive multiple dimensions by going through a black hole was fascinating.
Right.
And anytime you try and showcase four dimensions on a two-dimensional screen is very interesting. I think that's the only way I can put it, is very interesting.
Right. It really was. That movie, so the Christopher Nolan, the director, he hired a theoretical physicist. His name is Kip Thorne, and he wrote a book in conjunction with the movie that basically described all the science behind the movie. Mm-hmm. And it started out with every chapter was saying, this is legitimate, this is somewhat legitimate, and this is not legitimate. And then it would describe all the science that was used in that portion of the movie. Anyways, I highly recommend reading that book. I will say that the middle of the book is insanely dense and really required a couple – like I had to reread a couple different things to grasp kind of what he was trying to say. So a little bit different from these two books in that it wasn't, it was dumbed down in the beginning, but really kind of lost that dumbing downness. And but overall, I was gonna say because he talks about the perception, the multi-dimensional perception, especially when in the one scene where he is looking through the bookcase and is perceived to be in something beyond the third dimension, most likely like the fourth or fifth or whatever. And he's talking about how the theory behind that is actually not out of the realm of possibility, and the actual transfer or the wormhole was more unrealistic than that existing. And I was like, wait, what? Like from a physics perspective. And it just made me realize how little I know. But two, also, it kind of goes back to that that point overall in general as well. So it was interesting. Mm-hmm.
It made me think, well, getting a little deep in here, of The Hitchhiker's Guide, when the entirety of Earth was just created to answer one alien species question. And it, you know, when you're talking about different dimensions and what we can perceive from our vantage point, I mean, for all we know, that could be true. And I haven't watched much, but I believe there was a Rick and Morty episode roughly akin to that, where his car engine was an entire society, that the whole society's goal was to produce energy, and then they had a society that was tiny. Again, I haven't watched much, but I did see that. And what if there's a bigger society above us, and we're the ants?
Right. Yeah.
And a lot of that can be paralleled back to Rod Serling's Twilight Zone episodes. There's several episodes about a lot of what we've been talking about today.
I am thinking about that. One of the images that will stick with me from astrophysics is Tyson said that if the globe were the size of a pool ball, that it would be equally as smooth.
Right, yeah.
So when we think of, like, even small mountains, not even bringing up Everest or the depths of the ocean. I mean, when you're biking and you have to go up a small hill, how big that seems to you, that on a cosmic scale, we're smooth.
Yeah.
I think that's why my mind sometimes wanders reading and listening to this sort of thing.
I was gonna say, rightfully so. Well, and then also the question about how, and this is kind of what Russ was alluding to with the balloon example, is like, okay, so we have an ever-expanding universe, but what happens when you're on the outside of that expanding universe? What is out there?
Yes.
Like, it's crazy. And then I guess there's theories that there's multiple universes, but potentially in existence, and you're just, at that point, you're so far beyond the realm of our perception that it's hard to grasp.
Well, I think it's kind of neat that we as humans want to study this, too. And not only astrophysicists and other prominent scientists that are studying this, but to the point that, like, we're pretty average Joes. Like I said, my job is essentially pushing papers around on a desktop, but this is something that fascinates me. And that was another quote Tyson had early on in the book that said, you know, at some point in time, we've all stood outside and looked up at the night sky and wondered, where do I fit? So I almost think it's ingrained in human nature to try to understand, but also kind of ironic because at no point in time during any of our lifetimes are we going to reach a point where we can even see the Earth from space, frankly.
Right. Yeah.
And that's kind of a lot to think about. You know, we can detect minute shifts in stars billions and trillions of light years away, but realistically, I'm never going to put my feet anywhere other than on this one planet. No matter how many we detect.
I wasn't sure if it was either of these books or if it was something else I read, but one of the questions that I wanted to ask was, why do you think we haven't encountered alien life yet? And can you refresh my memory? Did either Brian or Neil bring this topic up and some of the theories they discussed on these books?
I was going to say, if I recall, I thought he like touched on it, but he didn't. I don't know if he talked about any actual theories behind it. I actually don't remember whether he touched on it. Because
No.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure the theories I heard were Neil deGrasse Tyson's, but I don't think that he mentioned them in this book. And that, of course, reminds me of the movie Contact. All these planets, so many of them could inhabit life, and it seems like an awful waste of space. But some of the interesting theories that I heard him postulate were, you know, perhaps alien life is out there, and they're completely ignoring us because we aren't advanced enough. Or what if alien life is out there and they're so advanced that they just don't even notice us? Or some of the scarier theories, like there are other aliens out there and they're just keeping good and quiet because there's some monster predator race, and as soon as they find us making all this noise, they're going to come get us. Which makes me wonder, like Star Trek the Motion Picture, is it really a good idea to be sending all these satellites way outside of our solar system advertising our location?
With Chuck Berry.
Send more Chuck Berry.
Right.
I don't know. What do you guys think?
I mean, I think it depends on which series or show or book you've read most recently as to what you prescribe to. Wasn't Star Trek... the aliens knew we were here but didn't bother to drop in on us until we had warp drive.
Mm-hmm.
And, mm-hmm. I mean, the X-Files says the aliens were here first and that we're alien.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it really just depends on what you've been reading, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons I like Babylon 5, because they basically said that, yeah, there's lots of aliens out there, and eventually you're going to become so advanced that you're just not even going to care.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, is that I'm trying to remember what it's called. I think it's the Fermi paradox, that the massive scale of the universe leads to the notion that there are billions of galaxies in that universe. And then if there's billions of galaxies in the universe, then the probability of actually having a sun with a similar like planet such as the Earth is high. And yet...
It has to be, right?
Right. Yet we don't... Like, yet there's no interaction or nothing in terms of our observable universe that we've been able to interact with. And so that... I mean, that's the thing, is that also, just from a time perspective, and I think this kind of goes back to the underlying thematic point of our conversations, is that, again, going back to our perception, is that there could... Just as probable as there is that life exists in the universe... It's equally as probable that so much of the life that's relatively close to us has either already existed for millions and millions and millions of years and now no longer exists, or existed for millions and millions of years and went somewhere else, or existed for a short period of time and then was wiped out. It's I guess, and those are what, so I just came off with three in my head, and now I'll just like multiply that by billions and billions and billions. And then I guess it leads to the overall conclusion that it's possible, and who knows? It might happen.
I think so. It's pretty, well, I guess it's fun to speculate about. I think that's one of the reasons that science fiction and science culture is so prevalent today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, not only is it sort of fun to put yourself in a different universe, but it's fun to postulate about what is the truth and what is the answer and how did this happen, and is it possible that with the billions of possibilities out there, this is the only spot that we grew up in, this perfect little... Tyson used a specific, like, it wasn't comfort zone, but
Goldilocks zone.
Yeah, Goldilocks zone.
You know, this can't realistically be the only planet in a Goldilocks zone, can it? But we don't have evidence that it's not, but it would seem to be pretty egomaniacal to think that we are.
Right, yeah.
Well, that's true, but, you know, part of what either Neil or Brian said was that detecting planets is hard. I mean, we can see stars, we can see other galaxies, but detecting planets, one of them has to go in front of another star in order for us to see it. And it's only been, what, the last 100-150 years we've been able to really notice other planets?
Yeah, but at this point in time, we're noticing them...
Yeah, we're starting to.
Monthly, weekly, daily, right?
Are we?
Eh. Maybe.
I thought we were picking up on new star systems fairly regularly, but planets are still hard to come by. But then again, radio waves. How come with all the monitoring of the skies we're doing, looking for some kind of electromagnetic spectrum wave with intelligible signal in it, we got zippy so far?
We got the wow signal. Although it's been explained away recently, I believe.
Whipping out Wednesday?
No. I should have studied up on it. I believe it was from the observatory in Puerto Rico.
Okay.
Where they were watching the skies, and out of nowhere, you know, I'm not going to get the math right at all.
Okay.
Usually we're at like a 1.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden we were at 100.
Hmm.
And the difference was so great that the scientist that was there at the time just wrote wow exclamation point in the margin. So it's been known as the wow signal.
Oh, okay.
And I think that recently it was explained away. It was, in fact, Tyson probably touched on there were certain stars that gave off radio signals or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. But for years and years and years, it was the wow signal.
Mm-hmm.
There was our... We couldn't explain why it happened or how it happened or what it was, but wow. Mm-hmm. What happened there?
Right.
And I really wish I had looked... I wish I had more background, because that's about as concise as I can...
That's enough for our listeners to Google and find out on their own.
Yeah, Google that. Yeah.
Well, and the other thing I was going to say to that point is, because the Cosmos TV show that Neil deGrasse Tyson hosts, I don't know if it's still actually on. Yeah, I think it is. It might be. Mm-hmm. Anyways.
It's on Netflix, I think, or it was right. For a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, the actual like CGI that is used makes everything kind of extremely clear and very much like in our face and cool and pretty awesome. And then you go and see some of these pictures that they've provided to show that this solar system exists, and you're like, that looks like someone just dropped some sand on a sheet of paper. And it's like, like what is that? Like, how do you know that those are planets? And
have you considered cleaning your lenses? Yeah, there's right. Something clearly wrong there.
And it's just so, it's funny to think about, because that really does represent the limitation in how much we understand, or at least can observe from a planet perspective or from a another galaxy perspective, because those things are they're still very much like, looks like you took it out of the 1950s or something, out of a camera back then, and so that just shows how little actual observation we have, even though we're doing it all the time and discovering universes and discovering galaxies and planets and stuff like that. But at the same time, it's still very, very limited. And so I guess going back to the alien question, the way that we could potentially interact with them, aside from them showing up one day, is space travel, like interplanetary space travel, which obviously is so far away. And who, it's not a given that we'll even ever get there. But yeah.
Like that episode of Futurama.
Yeah.
When they wanted the end of Single Female Lawyer.
Yep.
Because it took so long to travel to their planet.
Well, maybe 60, 80, 50, 100, however long it takes years ago, somewhere aliens will show up demanding season 2 of Ascension.
Yep.
Hope I'm alive to see it.
That's right. Yeah.
The one other point I'd like to bring up is one of the things we talked about was extra dimensions. I think it's fascinating that, and I wish I could understand this even remotely, but that string theory is a great theory, and it apparently requires there to be 11 dimensions for it to work. I have no idea how that's supposed to work. I like the idea of, imagine a string, a one-dimensional string looping in on itself and that causing a new dimension. And of course, we all talked a few minutes ago about how beings that we're used to seeing in existence know their dimension and the dimensions below it, but have a hard time perceiving those above. If you want to read more about that, I would strongly recommend reading Flatland. Have you heard of that?
I haven't.
It's not precisely a science book. It's actually more of a religious book. But if you read the story, it's about some two-dimensional beings that wind up encountering three-dimensional beings and one-dimensional beings. And the point of the book is to say, if you were to encounter a being from a higher dimension, you wouldn't be able to perceive it. So if we perceive this being from a new dimension, well, that's God. That's where he comes from, because it was written by a monk. But thinking about that in terms of what would we experience if we were to see a fourth dimension? What would we actually perceive? Would we be able to perceive it? It's actually also a really quick read, so I'd recommend that one.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's a legitimate question, too. And this is what is also probably representative of my limitations of understanding this as well, is that so we know that the third dimension exists because we exist in it, but we perceive the third dimension in 2D. So I guess, does that just stop? Like, that same principle most likely doesn't apply if we were to see something in the fourth dimension or the fifth dimension all the way up to 11. And so if that's the case, and again, I don't know if it is the case, but if it is the case, then that theory can never, I guess, can never be legitimized or debunked, right? And then it just reinstills the general notion that anything beyond our dimension is a deity or a sentient being that is beyond our perception and thus in of itself a god. Which is funny, or well, not funny, but it's interesting to think about, because that doesn't always necessarily align with, especially when you think about traditional institutional religion and how the description of God is explained in that rhetoric, that's somewhat a little bit different from saying, oh, we're actually referring to something that is just beyond our perception. It's not necessarily something that has the ability to create a planet or the ability to create the universe or something like that. It's merely that there could be something that we cannot physically observe, and therefore it is in of itself a God.
Yep.
I think that was in Babylon 5 too, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure other sci-fi that I'm less well-versed with, but...
Well, there's a great show called Dark Matter. And I think it's...
I've heard of it. I haven't watched that one.
Yeah, they canceled it recently. And there was a big internet uproar. But yeah, it was... It's there's not much physics per se, mm-hmm. that they get into, but it's a crew that just finds itself on a ship and no one has any memory of how they got there.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it starts. And I liked it. I enjoy it. It's Canadian.
I think it's interesting how when talking about astrophysics, which is a purely scientific term, it's so difficult to not bring up in some form or another the concept of God. And is it because it's just so difficult for us to understand that it's easy to say, you know, it must be a God? Or even Tyson addresses it in the beginning when he's talking about the Big Bang. He says, we don't know how or why this happened. And he almost uses a derisive term, like, well, some religious people say that it was God. But if you can't explain how it happened, then how do you definitively say it wasn't? And I mean, I'm not, we're religious. I'm religious, but I wouldn't say that I'm exceptionally devout. I'm very interested in science and that sort of thing. But I do think it's interesting that in general, these really heady scientific topics tend to circle back to, well, if we can't explain it,
right?
We must have that godlike concept somewhere.
Right.
It's. Okay. I think it boils down to the fact that God has always existed one step outside of our understanding. When it was, you know, cave paintings or you know, early Egyptian things that they didn't understand, like why is this giant warm ball rising over here every morning and setting over there every morning? Well, it must be God. So we learn about that a little bit, and it keeps getting one step further. You know, it used to be sea monsters. It's not sea monsters anymore. Now we're talking about space aliens.
Yeah, right.
Could be, yeah.
And also going to that point about how it's kind of dismissed in the general rhetoric of both these books. Interestingly enough, if you're saying that, oh, well, you can't actually disprove it, then you end up being an extremist on just on the opposite end by saying
that, yes,
like rather than like settling somewhere in the middle and being like, well, we don't actually know, like we're most likely trying to figure all this stuff out over time, but just dismissing it blindly like that is, yeah, I think it does a disservice and maybe also potentially limits the readership, although astrophysics I think was like on the New York Times bestseller list for a long time, so I guess the readership is out there.
But I agree that you can potentially limit your readership by making those sort of broad generalizations. So I think he touched on it, Tyson, but did a pretty good job of a relatively good job of keeping himself in check. Even he narrated the book. Well, not narrated. He read his own book himself. And he kept his tone of voice pretty even keel throughout that section, which was good. Although you could tell he was definitely delighted with himself in some points.
Yeah.
He particularly enjoyed the discussion about the whipped cream on top of the hot chocolate.
Yeah.
Like, well, unless you bent the rules of astrophysics in your cafe, you just forgot my whipped cream. All right. All right, Neil, listen, let's just back it up a little, okay? You just ask him nicely for some whipped cream. His life is probably, you know, he works in a cafe. Right. Let's be kind to other people.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right, do we have any other comments we'd like to share about astrophysics for people in a hurry?
No, I enjoyed it. I think it would be a good I think this would be a good drift away kind of book. Like, I'd like to have some background noise to fall asleep to, or some background noise to, you know, work with my hands. Mm-hmm. And I think this would be a good one to have playing, just because it is so dense that I found it easy to let my mind wander and drift and imagine great possibilities and tiny microcosms, all while listening to listening to Neil read his own book in a very delighted sort of way.
Yeah, so for me, it helps me with my favorite genre, which I've definitely expressed on this podcast once or twice, which is science fiction. And so so it helps me provide some sort of underpinning to the books that I mostly focus on. So it's really nice in that sense that it gives me some ground game to evaluate what is the actual fiction that's separating this book from just being a science book. So
I like it.
So yeah, it helps out with that. So I really like them as well. I liked them.
Agreed.
Yeah, and as I mentioned before, I enjoy both of them because they do challenge your perception of reality and make you think of things outside of just how you perceive them and how you deal with them on a day-to-day basis.
All right. So in addition to being joined by Andrew and Sarah, we also took a moment to record with our good friend Sam. She read Astrophysics for People in a Hurry, and I imagine she had a few things to mention about it. Sam, we all felt like this book was fascinating and really stretched our brains. Maybe a little bit heavy, but on the opposite side of heavy, it was mercifully short. What was your opinion on the book?
Oh, man, I definitely would say I agree with you. It had those a few moments where you could almost feel the brain wrinkles forming because it was really laying a lot of information in a short text, you know, but it was definitely enjoyable. It was easily digestible, even though it took a minute to chew on. It was definitely written in a way that I felt was understandable. And thankfully, you know, he kept it short. By the time the end of the book came, you know, my mind had already been blown a few times over. So I don't know if I could have done, you know, quite a few more chapters of it. But like I said, he did it in a way that it was easily digestible. It wasn't just dry information. He managed to sprinkle relevance and analogies that made it, you know, good to read, made it interesting to read and fun to read, despite the heavy subject matter that we were tackling.
Well, let me ask this. Was there an aspect of either this book or the science that he brings up during this book that you found particularly fascinating?
Well, for me, the one that I thought, well, the whole thing is interesting to me. I love physics. I love astrophysics. I love space. Like, I'm all about it. I think it's so interesting. But one thing that he thought that I thought was really interesting that he posed, and it's especially relevant now, is the whole life coming from other places, how life evolved, how it began, and how, you know, some people theorize that life may have come from another planet, come from Mars, when a stray rock, you know, smacked into Earth one day and brought these elements that, you know, created the perfect storm that made life possible. And I thought that that was really interesting. You know, it's something that I had definitely never really considered before. I don't know much about astrophysics or anything like that. But this book, again, made it easily digestible, and it made me think about some of these things that I hadn't really considered before. And for me, that was one of them. I thought that that was such a fascinating idea that, hey, you know what, if not for Earth passing through all this dust, if not for all these rocks hitting Earth, maybe we may not be here. And I know it's not something that he really harped on or kept with, but that's definitely something I thought about. And I thought it was especially relevant because scientists in Italy today, I believe they said something about discovering a frozen lake or underwater lake of some kind on Mars. And I was like, wow, that really, you know, harkens back to what I was reading just a couple days ago out of that book. So I don't know if it was just like one of those things that it stuck with me. And coincidentally, this announcement was made, you know, today being the 25th of July, this announcement was made. And I was like, wow, that's really interesting. It brought a whole other aspect to the book that I hadn't even really considered. You know, it's crazy to me that they've done so much and they're still working on it. All these things that he was talking about, this is something that people are still looking at. They're still working on, they're still considering. You know, he made it very clear that, hey, none of this is set in stone. We've got a lot more to discover. And that, you know, really framing the book, several chapters in the book that way, made it so that way it was a good read. It made it so that way you wanted to learn more about the subject. I probably will take on Fabric of the Cosmos, you know, even though I didn't have a chance to read it this round, I probably will take it on because he really generated my interest in the subject, even though it was a little bit there before. I feel more comfortable trying to take on a little bit more of it now.
Yeah, one of the topics we definitely discussed earlier was how science continues to build on itself and how we're constantly stretching the boundaries of what we know and trying to theorize on where we're going next. So, and this is very Carl Sagan and contacty, but how likely is it that we're the only planet in the universe that has life on it? And maybe framed from your point of view, the question could be, how likely would it be that life that is on Earth now could have been anywhere else at some other point?
Yeah.
Or perhaps has traveled from here to some other place.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more with y'all. I feel like it'd be almost arrogant of people to think we are the supreme intelligent beings in the entire universe. You know, I feel like there's got, even despite us not having seen it, there's got to be something else out there. And, you know, in the book, you know, he posited that we're starting to expand our understanding into multiverses. And so it's entirely possible that our universe is alongside another universe that has something entirely different going on. Mm-hmm. And we're having trouble, you know, crossing those boundaries. It's, you know, the way we're beginning to expand and look at things, for the further out we get, it almost like we're waiting to discover it. I feel like it's just almost inevitability that there's something else out there. I don't know if it's necessarily like humans or bugs or birds or what it might be. You know, it's probably something none of us could really think about, but he definitely posits it in a way that, you know, if there wasn't life before, just because we haven't found it doesn't mean it wasn't there before. We can't in the future. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that was really, to me, that was one of the really, even though it was a small portion, it was a really fascinating portion of the book. That and when he was discussing dark matter.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about y'all, but I had some trouble wrapping my mind around dark matter, you know, and the way he was describing it. It was tough for me. He like I said, he described it in an easily digestible way, but that was one of those times I felt my mind stretching, you know?
Yeah, I can see that. Somehow dark matter doesn't pose the same challenge as a few other topics do to me, but I think that's partly because they come right out and they say that
there's gravitational influence across the board that seems to say that there's something there that we can't see. That's pretty much all we know.
Yeah.
Whereas when I start thinking about string theory and super string theory, in particular how string theory requires up to 11 dimensions for the theory to actually work, and I have a hard time seeing anything outside of 4 dimensions, let alone 5, 6, 11. One thing we talked about a lot earlier was any being can easily perceive the dimensions that it exists in. Mm-hmm. By looking at it in one fewer than what it exists in. We live in a three-dimensional world. We perceive it in two-dimensional ways. It makes sense to us. We can imagine two-dimensional beings and imagine them perceiving their two-dimensional world in a one-dimensional frame of view. But for a four-dimensional being, seeing things in three dimensions, that's kind of hard. And once you go past that, I have no way of following what that could possibly even be like. What do you think?
Oh, man, I couldn't agree with you more. Those things become... To me, that's beyond my understanding and probably beyond my ability to comment on, just because it's not something I've read enough about. But it definitely is something that I found interesting. And just like you said, it's mind-stretching to try and conceptualize that. It's, to me, you know, like I said, it's not something I'm really qualified to comment as much on. But it's, as I've read little bits here and there, you know, I feel like all of these theories, you know, reading them at the time that I'm reading them, I feel like all of them are plausible and they all work together. But at the same time, it's just so hard for me to come, you know, mm-hmm. to come with one that I can gravitate towards, for lack of a better word. You know, I can't come to one that I can settle on enough to look into more in depth, because they are all so interesting and fascinating and believable as you're reading them, you know?
Mm-hmm. So how do you feel like this... a book or theories reading this kind of information influences you in some of the fiction that you read? We all kind of agreed earlier that reading stuff like this helps us more appreciate science fiction, and we're all big science fiction fans. So what's your take on that?
You know, I definitely, now that I've read this book, I do want to go back and reread one or two that, you know, that I've read already, specifically one, I think I might have mentioned it before, just like in passing, but one called Flash Forward, which is just a short fiction novel. It's very interesting. It talks about neutrinos in there. It talks about all kinds of different little things. And I feel like now, you know, that are astrophysics related, that now that I've read this book, I could go back and read that book and get a little bit more out of the story, out of the you know, character, because one of the characters in the story, the main character, is a physicist. I feel like I could get more understanding out of his passion and what it is that he was talking about and working with. And that's just one book I can think of. I imagine as I go back, because I occasionally do like to reread, if I go back and read Ender, for example, mm-hmm. I may have a different understanding now, you know, of the mechanics and the way that they were describing things and you know, stuff like that. It definitely is coloring my understanding and inspiring me to want to reread one or two science fiction novels that I've already read. Mm-hmm. It gives you a greater depth of understanding. When you're reading, you know, books about space, like, you have the idea of it from, you know, when you were a kid and you got exposed to it as that. But then when you start reading it at a different level from somebody who is as learned, trying to explain it to you that way, mm-hmm. You know, it makes your imagination just that much greater. It adds a little bit more to it. You know, and it probably will give you that little bit of a, you know, better immersion experience the next time you do visit outer space in another book, you know, in a fiction, you know, sense.
One thing that was brought up was kind of the overall theme of Tyson's book. Specifically towards the end, he gives a bit of a lecture that, especially towards the beginning, feels a bit on the preachy side. Now, me personally, I felt like when he comes to his point about what he calls the cosmic perspective, I really kind of gravitated towards that hypothesis of his, that theme, and understood from a great perspective how he's trying to keep us humble, but at the same time hopeful. And I really enjoyed that a lot. What did you think of that ending and the thesis of the book in general?
Oh, I really enjoyed it. I feel like at times it did come across a bit preachy. I feel like at times, you know, and I guess you'd have to be pretty bold and pretty secure and pretty confident in what it is you're going to do if you're going to jump into the branch of astrophysics and really try to take on how the universe began and how it functions. You know, there would have to be a touch of that, you know, confidence and to bordering on arrogance. And that's in the very beginning of the book when he kind of, he said like something along the lines of some people would call it religion or spirituality and they would be wrong. Like something along those lines. In the beginning of the book, it felt like he was hitting it a little bit hard, but as he explained throughout and as the book progressed, by the time he did get to the end where he was describing the cosmic perspective, it all did make a little bit of sense. It hit you hard a little bit at first, but it definitely did make some sense. And going in with the understanding that we are going to be talking about, you know, things that are unconfirmed and people have strong beliefs about, you know, some of those things needed to be checked at the door in order to get the best out of this book, the most out of this book. And by the time he brought it around to laying out the cosmic perspective, I believe he liked that list that he went through is of all those different things that as he saw it, you know, it all made a lot of sense and it all was given to you in a way, was written out for you in a way that, you know, it even though he did border on arrogance there, it's not how he meant to come across by the end of the book, is how I felt. Even though in the beginning he may have been hitting it with you hard, by the time the end of the book came around, you kind of got the feel for, especially with the way he wrote and some of his footnotes and his sense of humor throughout the book, by the time you got to the end, it ceased to be preachy and you began to understand more why he felt so sure and so confident in the things that he was describing and, you know, the theories that he was putting forward.
Yeah, yeah, I would concur with that. Was there anything else out of this book that you felt like, you know, either inspired you to want to learn about something else, or was there anything that it reminded you of, anything you've read previously that made you go, oh, this is kind of like that. I enjoyed that a lot.
Well, I do. It actually made me want to pick up. I saw a Stephen Hawking book aside this one, and I didn't get it. But now it actually made me want to go back and pick that one up, which looked very similar. I can't remember what it was called. I'll know it when I see it on the shelf. But, you know, when I was there, it looked a little big brain, looked a little intimidating, but it looked similar to the style that, you know, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry was written in. Not quite as condensed. But it definitely makes me inspired and feel a little more confident to tackle some of these things on because, you know, this is kind of big brain reading. It's big brain learning. And it at first sounds like it's a little intimidating, you know, to try and take on, especially when you're reading about pulsars and quarks and all these things that you feel like you should already know about. It starts off a little intimidating, but as you go through it a little bit more and it's broken down for you, it makes it so that way you probably feel a little more comfortable tackling a similar text. I probably couldn't hold my own with a professor, but at least they wouldn't want to, you know, jump ahead of me in the coffee line. They maybe wouldn't mind making small talk with me on our way to the front, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it was definitely a book that I feel like it can color your perspective now when you go in and look up at the sky, but it can also color your perspective if you're reading a certain type of book as well. It definitely was an inspiring book, and it was well written. I really, you know, enjoyed it.
Are there any books that you would recommend similar in this genre or at least in this written in this style?
No, this is my first foray. As much as I like the subject, my knowledge has been limited to like Googling and internet and just watching stuff like lectures on YouTube. You know, I haven't really read much in this subject. So this book really is inspiring me to want to get in a little bit more into it. Take that subject on a little bit more. You know, like I said, my fascination's always been with, you know, watching my main thing that I like to do is watch the lectures. I love the lectures. I'll just YouTube, you know, professor gives this or that lecture, and it's interesting to watch it that way. Reading it this way was a little bit easier, and it was a lot more fun. It made it so that the process was a lot more fun. And if you say Fabric of the Cosmos is in the similar vein, just longer, to me, this one, as much as it was mind-stretching, I wouldn't have mind, you know, I wouldn't have minded a little bit more. It would have taken me definitely longer to read it. You know, I wouldn't have minded a little bit more. If Fabric of the Cosmos is written in the same vein, I wouldn't mind spending a little time, you know what I mean, on that one. This book definitely inspired me to want to get into more. You know, I haven't read, I feel like this is what I haven't read enough about. I had a subject I haven't read enough about. So I wish I could suggest more, but I'm definitely open to taking a few suggestions because this one's, you know, definitely sparked a little bit more of the interest that I had in the subject before.
I think you'd really enjoy Fabric of the Cosmos.
Yeah, and that one was right here by, in the library when I was going through. This, they were nearby each other, mm-hmm. and somebody else had it reserved. This one I had gotten reserved from the library, and then I just went and bought a copy because I liked it. But when I went to get Fabric of the Cosmos, somebody else, it was on the hold shelf for somebody else, and, mm-hmm. you know, can't take somebody else's book. No. My place in line is pretty far down at the library, so I'd get to that one.
So was there anything else about this book that that caught your attention that we haven't discussed just yet?
You know, I can't really say there was. I liked just the overall tone of the book, the overarching, you know, tone of it. It made me inspired to want to look up some of the stuff that he was talking about. The main portion that I found most fascinating, most interesting, and that I want to almost just go over again is probably the chemistry portion where he was talking about astrochemistry. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's what he was calling it. Mm-hmm. That part to me definitely really stuck out, how he kind of went through the periodic table and gave me an idea of not only what these elements do, but the history behind the names and the, you know, the context that comes along with it. I really enjoyed that part, you know, of the book. I thought it was definitely something that stood out. It made some of what the other topics that he was discussing a little bit easier to read and digest as well. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's definitely a portion that I feel like stuck out. Definitely enjoyed enough to highlight a few times and take notes on and, you know, want to look up a little bit more about as well. So I think if there were anything that really stood out most, it would definitely be that short section of what I had mentioned earlier about Earth going through so many rocks that maybe something was brought here that inspired life. And then the other part would definitely be the chemistry portion. Those two portions made it so that way the subject matter was, you know, understandable. It brought it into to perspective. So that way the subject matter was easily digested is how I felt.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I can concur with that. Well, if we don't have anything else to discuss about Fabric of the Cosmos, I'd like to know a little bit more about what else you've been doing lately. How's your summer going? What you've been reading, doing? And what do you think we ought to discuss next on the podcast?
Oh, well, summer's, you know, like I mentioned earlier, summer's been a scorcher. We've been definitely taking a hit as far as hot goes. So, you know, summer's been great. It's been a good season it's always a good season for Texas. And it's so hot that, like, I'm getting good gardening going on, getting good tomatoes, which makes me happy. So summer this year has been an absolute, if I had to put it on a scale of 1 to 10, I probably had an 8 so far. We got a good couple months left, too. So I'm looking forward to getting it up to the 10. On my reading list, I've been staying inside because it has been hot, you know. Mm-hmm. So we've been reading books. And on my reading list, I always enjoy anything. I love, everybody knows how much I love young adult books, and Rick Riordan put out, I know I'm probably butchering his last name, I don't even know if I said it right, he put out another installment of his Magnus Chase series, so I'm rocking that right now. I absolutely love him. It's his series that he's doing about a hero who works with the Norse gods in Norse mythology. Mm-hmm. I love it. It's a really good book. It's a long book, and I love long books. I love something that's going to take me a good, you know, good amount of time. So I'm reading that one. It's the third installment in his Magnus Chase and the God of Asgard series. So that's on my reading list right now. And I think that's actually about it. I don't have a whole lot going on in the library section, you know, this time around.
Go ahead, Andrew.
So I am reading a book called Artemis, and it is not a sequel, but it's the second book by Andy Weir, who wrote The Martian. Yeah, and it's a completely separate story and unrelated, and I'm only a quarter of the way into it, but it's enjoyable. I will say that it's not as page-turning as The Martian was. That's right. Yeah, it's no Martian. It's just a moon. It takes place on the moon. But yeah. So I'm TBD on whether I would recommend it.
All right. That's it. How about yourself?
I recently finished Lonesome Dove for an upcoming podcast. I'm pretty excited about it. I mean, mild spoiler, but this was much better than I anticipated. And then Jack, who we record with sometimes, is reading The Thornbirds, which, Russell, your mother gave to me for my birthday.
The Wild Thornbirds?
I don't think the wild is in there. Gave to me as a birthday gift probably 2 years ago, and I went 4 to 8 pages in and said, you know, not right now. And she is strongly encouraging me to pick it back up and try again. So that's on my to read. And I just started The Stranger Beside Me, which I do enjoy true crime, and this is...
Gotta hurry up. Only got 3 weeks. We gotta record that episode.
Not a problem. I will definitely be able to finish it within that time frame.
Okay.
What about you? What you reading?
I am also reading Lonesome Dove. I'm about halfway through.
Do you love it?
I don't love it, but it's fascinating. I'm not bored with it at all.
Okay, fine. I'll take that.
Yeah. Rosanante.
All right.
Any other topics before we close out for the night?
I'm good.
All right. Thank you guys very much for joining us. We'll look forward to you on the next episode, and have a nice evening.
If you've listened to a few of our episodes, or even if this is the first one you've ever heard, we'd like to hear back from you. Leave us a review on iTunes, comment us on our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, or you could subscribe to our YouTube channel. We'd like to hear what you think, and of course, we're always looking for suggestions for novels to review for future episodes. Again, thanks, and we really look forward to hearing from you.